Welcome to Batted Sports. I'm Richard Holland.
And I'm Duncan McKenzie.
And Duncan, the fact that you're even doing this is completely admirable because you had part of your body hacked off in the last week.
It's true, I had an organ removed, but nothing can stop this show. Batted Sports must go forward, organless or not.
You're to be admired. So this week on Batted Sports, and this is why Duncan had to be here, because this is such an exciting show, we sat down with Chicago cartoonist Chris Ware, who, if you don't know who Chris Ware is, run out and buy his books as soon as possible, because this stuff is amazing.
Just get everything you can find with Chris Ware's name on it. It is awesome. Chris Ware himself changing the face of comics and their position as an art form in our kind of collective consciousness. So just go out and do it. It's awesome. And here he is. A Batted Sports announcement. Batted Sports is working on a new initiative to get the blog up and running all the time. So, there you will find Meg Only, Tim Ridlin, and Claudine Issei blogging the hell out of Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York City. And you'll also find the list of things that we're going to check out that weekend.
So, Duncan, if they wanted to read this fantastic blog information, if they wanted to become educated, if they wanted to learn something, where would they go?
As always, they would go to batitsports.com, Richard, where you can find it under the news section, which will probably shortly be changed to blog, but currently goes by the name News.
Very good.
Let's go, Bone.
That's because, Duncan, you're a social deviant in every possible sense of the word. Today, Batted Sports is delighted to be here with Chris Ware, well-known... Is cartoonist the right word?
Cartoonist is my preferred appellation, yes.
Okay. Is artist fair?
Artist is even nicer, but I wouldn't want to, you know, be too fancy or anything.
So. Okay. Occasional curator?
That's much less provable, but you can say it if you want. I've only done it once or twice.
So. And you've edited a number of collections?
That's right. Yes, I have.
You're a Renaissance kind of guy.
You're carrying it way too far, but you're very generous of you.
You also publish a Ragtime publication on the Ephemera. Ragtime Ephemera, is that its
name? It was called the Ragtime Ephemeralist, and I ceased doing that about, I think it was 2002.
Oh, okay.
And then my daughter was born, so I just don't have time for it anymore. It was a hobby, and I took it up to try to kind of just figure out where that particular phase of American popular culture came from, and once I more or less figured it out, then I shouldn't say I lost interest in it, but maybe I just overdosed on it. So and now I don't even listen to any popular music anymore, really, at all, just classical music. So
sorry, I completely blew my train of thought.
Let me start over. We'll do that three times now.
You were going on about how great Chris Ware is and how visionary and influential he is in the current comic book cosmology, but how he's also been widely embraced by the art world as both a visionary comic producer and an incredible graphic designer.
Well, that's very kind of you. I don't know how true it is, but I think comics are still, I think, trying to find whatever toehold, however slippery, in the art world, and I'm not sure. It depends on what kind of cartoonist you are, whether your original pages actually look good on a wall or not. I think personally mine look terrible on a wall. They look like technical drawings for the little folded up piece of paper that comes with your watch or something. You know, they don't really have any liveliness to them or something. But somebody like Gary Panter, who really thinks about the page as a finished drawing. He even said once that he likes to think of all of the comics he's ever done as just one big giant drawing that he's not done with yet. So he's clearly thinking like a fine artist, and I think more like a sort of a emotionally impaired printmaker or something. So.
Does that feeling come from the Masters of American Comics show?
I think that was probably the most visible point in that kind of flirtation with museum walls. I have comic artwork all over my house because I love looking at it. I find it very inspirational. But at the same time, comics are intended to be printed. They're intended to be read. They're not intended necessarily to be looked at as drawings. They can be, but it just depends on the artist whether they're able to keep both of those aspects of it alive. I tend much more towards the typographical and the readability as opposed to the lookability and the lush drawing, because I find that really interferes with the story as far as readability goes. So.
But a lot of your pages really have a very, and you have a lot going on in terms of the overall design. It's not like you're doing just the straight, you know, like Kirby 9-panel, you know,
right.
Page. I mean, you're doing, you know, it seems very thoughtful, and a lot of times you'll use macro sort of design elements, or you'll have things in the margins to sort of move people's eye around.
I don't want anybody to feel ripped off when they get one of my books, you know. I want to feel like I've used every part of the page to its, you know, hopefully its fullest extent. Plus, at risk of sounding really pretentious, I want the books to have a similar sort of degree of texture that I see in the natural world. Like when I look at a tree and get closer and closer to it, right up to the point I get to a leaf, there are degrees of texture and legibility, for lack of a better word, that I guess I'm trying to reflect a little bit in the design of the book. So I don't want everything to just be at a certain scale. So
maybe it would be good to talk a little more about how you think about the book itself, because your books and the Acme Novelty Library books have been incredible as objects also, that they seem to be really thoughtfully constructed from every angle. I mean, one of the great and most delightful parts of reading those books is reading some of the kind of weirdness of the ads or the kind of very textual parts or the like legal statement at the beginning, because they're delightful and strange and weird. And it's one of the things that I think makes them so incredible is that they have been so well conceived and well crafted from the outset.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, again, as I said before, I don't want anybody to feel like they're being cheated. You know, books are relatively affordable things, unlike fine art, which is not affordable. You know, you can only go look at it. But pretty much anybody can have a book. Certainly anybody can pick up a free newspaper. But as far as my own books go, I want every single aspect of them to be as carefully thought out as we, as human beings, appear to be. You know, I'm not advocating the intelligent design thing here, but I'd like every aspect of the books to contribute to an overall feeling or sensation, or to a certain degree a book is sort of a metaphor for a person, I think. So I kind of think of them that way, as both from the outside as well as the inside, and how the pictures line up on the pages and what's in the center of the book and what radiates outward, depending on, you know, which of the particular books are, you know. But I don't want to just design them so they look nice and that's all. So you can see why I don't talk publicly very much. I'm just not, the words don't come easily to me, so I apologize.
You are
for
way
this.
Too humble, sir.
I want to actually harken back for a moment and talk about the evolution, because the Acme Novelty books that I'm thinking about are the late ones, like 18 and 19, 19 being the most recent, and one of the most incredible comic books I think I've ever read. Well, we're fond of you.
Wow. Okay. Well, I thought you were going to be mean or something. So.
No, we're not actually very mean.
Duncan and I are only mean to each other, really.
But how has that changed since you were working on one page for New City, way back when?
Well, I started doing strips for New City in 1992, and after I had a downtime, I guess, for lack of a better word, of about 6 or 8 months after I moved from Austin, Texas, where I'd done either daily or weekly strips for the student newspaper there. And I wasn't really doing them to plan any sort of with an eye towards making books at that point. But at a certain point of doing strips for New City, I started to realize what I was working on was a longer book. So I started to structure the strip in such a way that it could be reassembled then into a larger sort of book or publication. So, and the publications were just done on a sporadic basis as a way of staying alive, basically. So I think I did two or three a year in the 1990s. So I'm not answering your question at all. I'm sorry.
So there have been some accusations in the comic press and in a recent book called Reading Comics that you hate fun. You know, we once opened an interview with the local painter Wesley Kimbler, asking him who he hated. So, oh yeah, well. So, maybe an early question in this interview should be, do you hate fun?
Should I repeat my previous answer?
You can if you'd like.
Or
can
you
come up with something new.
Or you just want to go back
and edit it? No.
It'll lose a certain authenticity if
that's
I repeat
okay.
myself.
That's okay. We don't, you know.
Well, okay. First of all, I should say, I don't hate fun. I don't know if, anhedonistic, or is that the word? What was the title that Woody Allen originally wanted to call Annie Hall? Was anhedonia? Is the inability to feel, or the inability to have fun, inability to feel pleasure. I've got a house full of stuff that I love. I draw comic books for a living. I do silly jokes in them. I have cutouts. I want them to be attractive things. I want, that's all I'm interested in. So I don't understand
Well, I'm guessing that the sort of conclusion is because your work deals with, at times, issues that are sentimental or nostalgic or wistful or perhaps existential,
that's how I've experienced life. I mean, that's what life feels like, and that's, life goes by very, very quickly, and there's not a lot of time to appreciate the moments that you think are, like, the moments that are the most potent and emotional for you. Generally, you notice them after they've happened, sometimes weeks, months, or years later. And that doesn't exactly contribute to a sense of happiness, for lack of a better word. But at the same time, most of my stories are about people living in fairly cushy middle-class circumstances, but just unable to feel a certain thing. They haven't seen their parents burned alive, they haven't been through horrible political conflicts, they're not living in a terrible part of the world. So, I mean, there's much unhappier people in the world than there are in my story. So, I mean, that's part of the, hopefully, for lack of a better word, humor, I think, though that might not necessarily be funny. But
do you think that, we asked this question with sort of a wink and a nod, of course, but do you think it's because a lot of people still look at the comic medium as, something still rooted, which I think is a very antiquated notion, but still rooted in sort of juvenilia?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I think 100%. I mean, from the most simplistic view of comics is just something you read to laugh, but, looking at the Daily Comics page, to superhero comics still stuck in the public's perception as what comics really are. I was talking to Art Spiegelman a few days ago, and he said, you just can't change comics DNA in America. No matter what you do, it's going to snap back to being superheroes. It's just part of our generation's understanding of what comics are. So I think, you can especially see it in the movies of the past 10 or 15 years or so. I find it astounding that Iron Man was it nominated for an Academy Award, or wasn't it in the running, or wasn't there some...
I know Dark Knight was seriously considered.
But all these are movies, like, I got beat up in school for reading the stories that these movies are based on, and they're being considered, if not art, then at least tantamount to art. Yeah. And it's become such a part of the visual pop culture, it's embarrassing to me. And it seems to be completely in line with the foreign policy of the past, Eight years or so of just going out in the world and trying to fix the world's problems by being this kind of arrogant, muscle-bound nation or something. I don't know. I shouldn't say these things. I've said it before, but to me, the idea of superhero comics for adults, to me, is like writing pornography for children. It just doesn't make sense. That's the wrong audience, So But at the same time, there's plenty of people who like them. I can't. I grew up reading superhero comics. I grew up thinking I was going to be a superhero when I crossed over that line into adulthood or something. Needless to say, it didn't happen, you know. I just became more of a nerdy, loathed person, so...
Perhaps you weren't exposed to the right kind of radiation or
right.
cosmic rays.
Yeah, I was trying to mix together all the household cleaning products in my house, trying to acquire some kind of superpowers.
But don't you think that, I don't want to get off on too much of a superhero comic tangent, because I'm a complete dork about this, and I could talk about it for days.
Sorry, I've already insulted you or something.
No, not apologize. At all. No, but I mean, you bring up an interesting point that superhero comics, like... are so written for adults. I mean, the mean age for most comic shop denizens is like well into the 30s at this point. And I wonder if that trend isn't killing it off.
But are they really written for adults?
Well, they're written, I think they are. Like, I just read the, I just picked up the Daredevil, the Brian Michael Bendis Daredevil Omnibus.
Uh-huh.
That is not written
for kids
at all. I mean, that's really like dark, referential of only things someone in their 30s and 40s would have a handle on in terms of the cultural references. And I wonder if, you know, everybody in comics, like, I wonder what percentage of people who sees these movies actually has ever picked one up. And I wonder if the comics aren't doing themselves a disservice by sort of skewing that way. Like, maybe they should go more for a more mass audience.
I think it's just, it's like everything. I mean, the real reason that comics have become more visible in our culture is because the people... Well, we all grew up reading them, and we've gotten older. It's not because all of a sudden all of the old guys in the tweedy coats were like, oh, these comics look wonderful. They hate them as much as they ever did. But now, you know, our friends and people our ages have gotten jobs as editors at magazines or working in Hollywood, and that's why this stuff has become so.
How do you think... So if you don't think of your comics as being in the same... realm of things as, say, Richard Superman comics are, what are the other media that you think of them as operating like?
Well, I don't know if I think of them. I mean, they're comics. You know, it's the same thing. It's just the content is different. It's just, it's a similar form, but it's a completely different sort of storytelling. I mean, there are corny grocery store novels, and then there are novels that you necessarily wouldn't see in a grocery store. So it's... Comics are a medium, not a content. So, I mean, I think that's fundamentally what it comes down to. If you say comic books to somebody who's maybe not that familiar with them, they would say that they think, oh, superheroes, you know. So it's still used as a pejorative adjective in a lot of news stories or to describe something that's caricatured and simple or reductive or adolescent or something. So, I don't mean to be so judgmental about it all. It's... it is what it is, and that's, there's, you know,
no,
there's
but it,
nothing wrong with it. It's just
No, I don't disagree with you. I just think, like, it's funny to think about, because I think about reading, and I don't read that many superhero comics, but when I do, I think about them as, like, going to see a movie where stuff explodes a lot. And that is not what it's like to read one of your comics. Like, I have to prepare myself sort of emotionally for what I'm about to do. While I'm doing it, it's sort of emotionally punishing. And I sort of cringe awkwardly over and over again as I get so sucked into the pathos of the experience of these poor people.
That sounds awful.
And then, but when they're over, what's really weird about it is when it's over, you just want the next story. Like, it's such a kind of... incredible emotional ride that it's so totally worth taking, but it's punishing while you're on it.
Well, I think John Updike in a couple of articles for the New Yorker, I think he was reviewing a detective novel for the New Yorker about 5 years ago or so, and he very gingerly and brilliantly talked about the difference between, say, detective or genre fiction and fiction that isn't genre fiction, and I can't even begin to paraphrase it, but essentially the difference, and he said it in such a way that was almost synesthetic or poetic, but that what we think of as literary fiction actually hopes to or tries to connect with something within ourselves, whereas genre fiction, you know where it's going to start, you know where it's going to end, and it's going to be a lot of fun, but in the long run, when you're done with it, it's nothing within you is going to be changed, nothing within you will be questioned or any way. So I mean, that's I'm putting it in the flattest, most awkward paraphrase there, but I think, and it, no matter how you slice it, you end up sounding like a pretentious jerk who, you know, but I can't help it, so it's...
I think that you leave the experience of reading the essential Uncanny X-Men, you know, Volume 2, a lot different than you leave the experience of reading Jimmy Corrigan. I mean, there's sort of different aims there. I mean, and I think the genre versus, I mean, you don't want to say the sort of, it's like a fiction literature dichotomy because that, you know, but I mean, it's like when you go to the bookstore, there are different sections for a reason. And I think that there are different ends that are trying to be achieved. I think it is funny that, you know, I mean, I think of the sort of comics carried by Quimby's is so different than comics carried by Brainstorm down the street, you know, as somehow in different things in a lot of ways, but your point is that they're not, is really...
Well, it's just a medium. It's different storytelling within that medium, in the same way that there's good painting and crappy painting. You know, it's still all painting, so... When I was a kid, I collected superhero comics. I love superhero comics, and my grandmother was always trying to get me to read Robinson Crusoe, and I think I was about 12 years old, and I acquiesced as long as she promised to read a copy of an X-Men comic that I thought was really great. And I remember giving it to her and having her read it, and for some reason, just sitting looking at her reading it, I suddenly understood just by seeing her holding it how incredibly dumb it was. I was embarrassed to have her read it, and I to this day I still think of that, and I think that was sort of like the beginning or something there, where I think it was one of those comics too where somebody dies, you know, and they're holding him on the front cover and they're torn,
like
costume.
X-Men 137 or something.
I think that was actually it, I believe. So right, that was it. Yeah, so yeah, how embarrassing.
Oh, but is that any more embarrassing than the fact that Richard Holland can identify just with those few scant phrases exactly what book it was and what happened in it?
Not at all.
What other X-Men comic would you have somebody outside of that world read other than... That's a pivotal moment in the Marvel Universe.
Well, see, we all come from the same thing here. So it's my friend Seth, a cartoonist in Toronto, did well over 1,000 pages of superhero comics as a kid. I think I did 6 or something like that, but he created all these characters, these long labyrinthine stories, and he actually, in one part in one of his stories, there was a big panel like that where I think it was a character named the Cobra and then the Cougar or something, and one of them died, and they're holding, one of them's holding the other's body screaming, no!
I just read Scott McCloud's Zot, that trade paperback that just came out. And I don't know that he was ever, you know, I mean, I think that he wanted to sort of be somewhere in between, to sort of do the superhero genre, but not really do the superhero genre. And it's interesting to read having read his other work, because his other work, you know, understanding comics and so forth, seems like a world that he's much more comfortable in some ways. Like, I enjoyed Zot, but it just, well, if you haven't read it, I'll cut this entirely. It's just sort of pointless rambling.
And it did not bring up that anecdote about Seth in any way to slight him either. I think he's one of the great geniuses of comics, and he's managed to do things in comics that nobody's ever done before. So I'm just bringing that up to say, like, we kind of all came from this same base level of reading this stuff, you know, so...
Well, because you gravitate back to the things that generated wonder and amusement and joy for you as a kid, and you just complicate them now as a grown-up.
Which is why I think, I guess, I kind of clung to them in art school, sometimes to great detriment in my critiques, but still holding on to something that I really genuinely loved as a kid and trying to keep that sense of making something for the sake of making it, and not because you're trying to make a point, but because you really love doing it. So it's very hard to parlay that into something that then communicates something emotionally to another person. But
I wondered about your art school experience on the way here, because I was thinking about mine and how quickly comic books and a love for comic books were just beat out of me very quickly in art school. And almost seamlessly, like, walked in day 3, savagely beat day 4, totally new human being. And I wondered if you had found people that sort of mentored this relationship, or if you just kind of kept being resisted in this sort of comic book urge over and over again.
It was a little bit of both, actually. I guess now, though, I've heard from a number of students, actually, that they're offering classes in comics in almost every single department, including the fiber department, which seems amazing to me. But anyway.
I think really that's at this school you're quietly referencing but not saying. I think there's just a scramble to kind of own that medium.
Well, again, it's been, 18 years since I was in school, so it's a whole another generation and a half now of people coming in with things that interest them and that they've felt the world through and that they want to continue to feel the world through in their own artwork. So I think fundamentally the problem that I had in art school was just convincing some of the teachers that reading a picture was as okay as looking at a picture. I frequently would have to convince instructors on a critique panel or something to just, read the story that I'd written rather than looking at it as an object or as an image, which admittedly they were pretty terrible images and pretty terrible objects. At the same time, I had, I think, two of the greatest teachers in the world there, Richard Keene and Bob Lesher. Bob Lesher was the head of the art history department for a long time, and he never put up any walls between himself and any artwork. He immediately responded emotionally to everything, which I found very, very valuable, and he was very honest with me about whether what I'd done that week in the newspaper worked emotionally or was forced or sentimental or just false. That was really invaluable. And it's the same thing with Richard Keene, who taught life drawing for decades there, especially during the years of the abstract expressionism, abstract expressionist times, where he was told repeatedly that nobody would draw the human figure anymore. Like, he was the last holdout. So, I actually had a really good experience there. There were times, though, where I'd be made fun of for... I was constantly called an illustrator, and I would try to say, well, I'm not really illustrating anything. I'm creating stories out of pictures, but it's kind of hard to argue your case, That's fair enough, too. It's just a generational thing, so... But,
My wife studied with Bob Lesher.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And really loved him, and they got along famously. So we went out to dinner one night to, his favorite restaurant, which was some heavy French... Like, it was a place that would sell him the cow's liver. I mean, he was just, they knew him, and it was ready when he showed up. I mean, really.
Right.
And within 10 seconds of our having a discussion, and I have a certain amount of art historical knowledge, but we were talking about comic books and pop culture, and we had a fantastic conversation. I don't think my wife got a word in. talking about Japanese animation, I think, is what got
really
started.
Really? Yeah. He was truly an omnivore.
So. He was an amazing guy. He really was.
I agree.
So then, is it weird now for you to go into an exhibition like the 2001 Whitney Biennial and see your work kind of hung as installation, or to see the super graphic way that it was installed in the MCA in Chicago in 2005? But how do those things feel to you now that you've kind of returned to that world? Very overtly. I mean, the Whitney Biennial is the thing that every artist in America hopes to kind of be included at some point.
Yeah, I couldn't have been more taken aback. I didn't expect it at all. By that point, I'd completely given up on making any kind of artwork. I made paintings and sculpture when I was at the Art Institute, and I thought of these things as going on art gallery walls, and at a certain point, I made the conscious decision, if you can make an unconscious decision, I guess you can't, but I decided not to make artwork for galleries anymore and just simply to make stories for print. So that then all of a sudden when I was asked to be in the Whitney Biennial, I was pretty surprised, and I thought, good God, what am I going to show? I can't hang these things up on the wall. But then I thought, well, what else can I put up? So that calls into question what we were talking about earlier, whether comic art actually works on the wall or not, because essentially it's just kind of it's like putting a printing plate on a wall or something. The finished object itself is a book. It's intended. It's a very solitary experience. It's not a social experience. But I couldn't be more grateful, certainly, to have been included in that, and certainly to be in the MCA show. That's probably be the highlight of my life. That's all downhill from here. So I'm really grateful to Lynn Warren.
You're only 41, though.
I know. Well, that's, you know, half my life sober.
We saw the Masters of America's American Comics show, and that was an interesting experience in a museum to see, you know. It was an odd mixture of people, I thought, but it was interesting that some of those things really worked as sort of visual art objects, and some of them you sort of just had to sort of stand there and read, and it's like, oh, it's a Jack Kirby page from, you know, an early issue of the X-Men. That's really exciting, you know. I actually thought your work worked better as visual art.
Really?
On the wall.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
No, I mean, I think that there was, your attention to design is meticulous, to say the least. And I thought that, you know, Winsor McKay, I think, worked as visual art because he was very interested in that. And I think some of the Will Eisner, where he sort of got wackier later on in his run on the Spirit.
I'm just not a good judge of those things because I tend to look at comic artwork so technically, just to see how things are done, that I'm not a good judge of how things look on the wall. So, but
that show was neat in terms of technical because it was like, you know, you got to see all the non-colored inked pages and original drawings. And
yeah, I don't. At the same time, the title of the show made me feel so horrible because I don't consider myself a master of anything at all. And then to be singled out from my generation as the representative of it was kind of painful and difficult because I feel basically like I'm just a vagabond. I've stolen all of these things from so many of my friends, like Dan Klaus and Charles Burns and people who weren't included in the show, and I felt like I didn't belong. And certainly Linda Barry should have been in that show, I think, definitely. She's, without her, I don't know what the word would be, advances in the art of telling fiction in comics, because everything she writes is fiction, even though it feels like autobiography, it's still fiction. She figured out a way to get down underneath the surface of comics and come back out with stories that felt real in a way that nobody had ever done before. And without her doing that, I don't think any of us that are trying to write fiction in comics would be doing what we are today. So,
when you were talking about your school experience, I was thinking to myself, because I know that there's a writing program now at the School of the Art Institute. And
there was when I was there, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, it seems like a lot of people in comics today would almost be better served in the lit program.
That's kind of what I think in a lot of ways. It depends. The thing that I like most about... I cannot start a sentence. One of the things I like about comics is that it's so flexible. It allows for somebody who starts from a literary standpoint or somebody who comes from a fine art standpoint to do equally interesting things. Say somebody like Gary Panter can do comics that are just as revealing and poetic as somebody, say, like Dan Klaus, who's probably the best writer that comics has ever seen. And I'm surprised at what a flexible medium comics is. Actually, I wouldn't have thought that 15 years ago. But you're bringing this up, actually. When I was going to the Art Institute, I had a correspondence with Linda Barry. I met her briefly one night with Art Spiegelman, and she started writing to me and encouraging me because I think I was, you know, despondent about not really knowing how to approach writing fiction in comics and feeling like I wasn't getting anywhere in art school. And she wrote me these long 6 to 10 page letters encouraging me and basically telling me stuff that I needed to hear, like just to trust yourself and how to allow the stories that are within you to come out naturally. And I sort of owe my life to her in a lot of ways for that. So,
do you think there's anything to... I mean, a lot of people in the, for lack of a better term, either progressive or alternative comics, more literary comic work, have lived or live in Chicago.
Is that true?
There's a lot of people who've been involved. You,
there
are a number
of people. Dan Klaus.
Ivan Brunetti.
Anders Nelson. So. Yeah, there's a lot of people who were here and are still here, so it's true. But we hardly ever see each other.
Yeah, there's not a comic bar anywhere.
No, where there's no chop house where we go and smoke cigars and talk about...
You should work on that.
I thought about it. I thought it would be kind of funny to do something like that. Maybe as real estate becomes affordable, we can just go squat in some abandoned restaurant or something like that.
You could, like, set up the comic bar in Oak Park, you know. There's plenty of abandoned storefronts.
Well, I see Ivan every week, we talk about, or almost every week, which is something we've been doing for years now. So but he's one of my very closest friends in the world. So,
you think it's just coincidental? It's
well, I mean, I've made jokes about it in the past, and that like I organized my stupid Acme book for Pantheon around the idea that the East Coast of America is the center of publishing, and the West Coast is the center of film. Essentially, that you know, the two opposing poles of reading and seeing, and then Chicago is right in the middle, so it's the perfect place for comics to be. As well, it's kind of, you know, isolated from the rest of the world, and it's sort of a mediocre, middling place to be. So, a place where you're more apt to stay home than leave the house. So,
which is funny. How much of the work that you make is autobiographical then?
Well, all of it. I mean, I think any artwork that any artist or any stories that any writer writes comes from within somehow. It's all got to go through the eyes at some point and then come back out through the brain. So, but it's not directly autobiographical. You can actually be more truthful, I think, in fiction than you can be in biography. Because when you're writing biography, your allegiance is to trying to remember what actually happened and to tell the truth, which is, as any writer will tell you, is completely impossible. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what the question you just asked me two questions ago, let alone reproduce this entire conversation. So anything I say is going to be filtered somehow through my mind. And for some reason, the mechanics of fiction allow you as a writer to float above everything and view it with the same sort of suspicion that a reader would when reading it. So hopefully, if you're at least a little honest with yourself and somehow attuned to the laws that kind of govern us all, you can then tell a story that is more truthful than if you're just simply trying to talk about your childhood or something. So, I mean, it's kind of a back and forth question, but I don't know.
No, that makes sense. So your first allegiance becomes to pathos, then, the emotional content that's delivered through it.
Well, no, I mean, not at all. I mean, I don't have any allegiance to any emotion at all. I mean, emotions are completely a human phenomenon. They don't exist at all. They are just completely within our minds. There's no such thing. So, I mean, if I could do anything at all, it would be to create stories that wouldn't seem to lean one way or the other towards any emotion at all, that if one person read it, they might think they were funny. Another person would think they were upsetting or sad or something. So, I think the goal of any writer would be to create such believable situations that, depending on who read it, they would have a completely different emotional response, but hopefully it would be a truthful one. So, I think as a young writer, I was aiming more at trying to get at a specific emotional tone or something, but I don't try to do that at all anymore. So. Again, it's all, you know, it's all, any real writer hearing this would just roll their eyes and say, oh my God, you know, it's like a 19-year-old talking about novel writing or something. I'm coming at it very slowly. As a cartoonist, everything is very, very laborious, and you arrive at things at a very slow, embarrassing pace, so.
How do you work? One of the things going through your books is always the question of how they get manufactured. Like, how do you actually make each page? Because it looks like painstaking and incredible if it's all done by hand, and then painstaking and incredible if it gets run through the computer, but a different kind of painstaking.
It's all drawn on paper, basically, known in the trade as Bristol board, Strathmore 500, I should say. Inked or drawn in blue pencil and then inked with, India ink, and then I scan it in and then I add color on the computer. I used to do color by hand, cutting layers for each, you know, tint that would be printed, and that was guaranteed headache a week. And this is now, I was forced into not doing that basically because most printers now work digitally, and I don't think I could even send a physical overlay anymore and have any printers really know what to do with it. So at the same time, digital color separation is so much better and more precise. So, and basically I can teleport my book to another country and then have it printed on paper and then sent back here. So it's kind of incredible, actually. So I don't know how much longer that's going to last, especially with the collapse of the entire world in the offing here. So, but it's been fun while it lasted. So.
I don't think we'll all collapse. So, this is a geeky minutia point, but I had wondered if all your books were spot colored at this point rather than process colored.
No, it's all process colored. It's all. There might be an occasional spot color, like this covers a single tone, but. The two stories I'm working on, specifically the red, yellow, and blue dots, especially in the Rusty Brown story, are built into the structure of the story themselves, so I couldn't do it any other way. So that halftone dot pattern is kind of part of the story. The other story is a little bit different. It's not as much a part of the underlying structure or core of it, but it's certainly the cheapest way to print. So I couldn't print 88 different ink colors, you know, unless I wanted to. It would be impossible, basically. So,
The book's color and tone compared to like Jimmy Corrigan are incredibly like in another universe in terms of color richness and intensity and vibrance comparatively.
Just 10 years ago. Oh, well, thanks. Well, printing has definitely gotten better. It's gotten a lot cheaper. The reason that I think, aside from what I mentioned earlier about all of us growing up and becoming adults and having read comics, and now we bring them into our adult lives, because of cheap printing in China and in Singapore specifically, where I print my books, that's allowed for this sort of explosion of experimental comics and publishing. I think that's one of the reasons McSweeney's has done so well, is we use the same Singaporean printer. I introduced them to him with number 13, and they've been using them ever since. So they're just really great printers, and they're affordable, and they very, very careful. So I like printers. I like talking to printers and working with them. It's very straightforward, kind of honest profession, you know. It's either wrong or it's right. So it's difficult, though, when you go to do a press check, and you see the people who are there at 4 in the morning, you know, running these presses, and you realize, like, you're there complaining about the density of a blue. I'm much more apt to allow mistakes into books when I actually see the people who are having to print them. I feel sorry for them. So
I mean, as a person, particularly as a person who works in a very in work that looks very technical, I mean, in a very high level of draftsmanship, the change in technology and the advent and inexpensive now, you know, technology to do graphical work. Do you think that's changed the medium greatly, and do you think that has had a effect on your work?
Well, like I said earlier about cheap printing, I think it has had an effect that it's allowed cartoonists who wouldn't have otherwise maybe found a place with a publisher to do their own work and to have it well presented and visible. But overall, I mean, the mechanics of making comics and the materials that go into them really haven't changed for 200 years. It's essentially just a guy sitting alone at a table with a bottle of ink and a piece of paper, and it's glorified doodling, for lack of a better word. So that's one of the things I like about it, is that it's no different. So,
do you find the computers opened up your investigations into the comic book medium?
No, not at all, really, actually. I mean, other than just allowing for publishing. Like, I have a little miniature production room in my bedroom, basically, but no, it hasn't, other than being able to print my own books. I think Art Spiegelman definitely started using a computer well over a decade ago to construct his stories, but I still do it just directly on the page, because every time I've tried to plan something or write it out or script it out ahead of time, I end up doing the worst work I've ever done. So there's something about sitting at a table with a pencil in your hand that allows for a certain degree of honesty on the part of the artist, and for things to come out that you otherwise never would think of on your own, just staring into space or in front of a computer keyboard. And you can take it to the level of, say, like Linda Berry does, where the handwriting actually communicates some emotional core of the story, or just simply, I don't know exactly how to put it, but I mean, when you're sitting at a page and you're drawing a story and you're essentially making it up, whatever you're drawing is coming out of your memory in some way or another, whether it's a house you lived in as a kid or a place you've just been that you've decided to use as a setting. But as soon as you draw that on the page and you look at it, ideas occur to you that you never would have thought of otherwise. And you might draw a person in the background, and all of a sudden you start thinking about that person, and before you know it, they might end up being a major character in a story. So there's something about remembering on the page in comics that I would never want to give up, basically. So that would not happen, at least in my own stuff, if I use the computer. So there's a cartoonist named Dash Shaw who's he's either in his late 20s or his early 30s, who's done web comics that I think are really, really interesting. He just finished something called Body World, I think, and it's going to be published by Pantheon either this year or next year. And I think he's found a way to use the computer in a way that's not forced or artificial, but it definitely has helped his or freed up his storytelling in a way. I feel like an impaired, brittle old man next to him. So
one of your great opportunities early on in your career was that you came to the attention of Art Spiegelman, who you mentioned before, who
uh-huh.
was one of the giants of alternative, for lack of a better word, alternative comics.
And, right.
You know, the author of Mouse, which is Pulitzer Prize-winning, wasn't it?
That's right.
It? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Pulitzer Prize-winning Mouse. What did he see of yours, and how did it end up in his hands that he was like, wow, you know? How many times have you told this story, like 5,000?
Oh, no. I was rolling my eyes only because of the garbage that he actually did see that I was doing at the time. It pains me to think of him looking at it. I was doing a strip for my student newspaper, the name of which I cannot even repeat to you because it's so embarrassing, but it was, he got a press clipping for Mouse, and on the back of it was one of my strips, and he saw it and ended up contacting me and saying that it looked interesting and encouraged me to do more, which, I mean, to me was like getting a call from God or something. You know, I've been reading his stuff since high school, and actually reading Mouse was the first time I realized that you could tell a story in comics that was, for lack of a better word, literary. And
doesn't get much more emotionally powerful than Mouse.
Yeah, I think people forget really how Mouse was. It really is the most important comic book ever published. I mean, it is. It showed how it could be done, and it's the most emotionally honest comic book ever published. When I say that, I mean a long story, as opposed to you know, the work of Robert Crumb, which is certainly the most important comics ever published as well, too. So, I mean, when you make these grand generalizations, you're apt to pick one over the other, even though I think they're both equally as important for differing reasons. So, anyway. So, and he's remained a really great friend. I talk to him all the time, basically. We sit and talk while we're working, and I'm amazed that that he was ever that encouraging to me, and it meant the world to me. So in a way, it's sort of like he's like the best dad you could have as a artist or a friend. So in a lot of ways, and he's never been anything but encouraging and generous.
You've been involved in the publishing of some historical collections. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, I find that stuff, I think it's a really up and coming and big trend in comics, and I think it's really exciting that these, sort of taking these things, you know, in the last 10 years, I mean, historical reprints have really kind of taken off. I mean, I know that you had some, and you could speak about what, hand in the Crazy Cat reprints, which are favorites of mine.
That was mostly just doing the book design and doing the covers. The books for Drawn and Quarterly, which are the reprints of Frank King's Gasoline Alley, who's a Chicago cartoonist, started around the teens in for various Chicago papers, but most specifically the Chicago Tribune, and started Gasoline Alley in 1918. It's always been one of my very favorite strips. I could never figure out why it was never reprinted. It's one of the most complicated comics ever drawn because the defining characteristic of it is that all of the characters age at the same rate as the reader would age if each single strip represented one day in the life of a person. So the strip started out as a jokey commentary on the fad of the automobile, which is where it got its title from. And then the main character found a child on his doorstep, and from that point on, it ended up being this strip about father-son relationship that really has some really profound and deep emotions woven into it, not least of which, given King's own biography, where he didn't see his own son for many years because his son was sent away to boarding school by his wife, all of which myself and the co-editor, Jeet, here found out from interviews and visiting Frank King's granddaughter who lives outside of St. Louis now. So the strips are just really beautiful. King found out, was really, I think, one of the first cartoonists to figure out how to communicate profound, slow, solemn tones and emotions and feelings in comics without altering the basic staccato structure of comics and drawing comics. He was relentlessly unpretentious in his drawing and his storytelling, but he still managed to do strips about autumn leaves and about the feelings that we all have towards people we love that we're not able to very easily express. So, and this stuff appeared in a daily newspaper for free, which I find astounding. It just seems inconceivable now that something like that would appear in a commercial newspaper or in any commercial medium for that matter. So I was thrilled that Drawn and Quarterly was willing to take it on as a republication project. So
I don't know if I have a good follow-up editing question. My last questions are sort of about restraint and where you choose to exercise it as an artist and I suppose as an editor. Because one of the things that I think makes the book so astounding is the moments where you choose not to draw things, or you choose to sort of leave it off, or you choose to go totally over the top and move us around in 1,000 different little panels, and how you make those decisions and where you choose to exercise that restraint and where you don't.
Well, in fiction and comics, the thing that those decisions must hang on are whether showing something or not showing something is going to have more of an emotionally honest effect. Because frequently, I mean, comics are an extraordinarily vulgar medium. That's why they're so good at telling jokes and at being funny. So trying to get at feelings and emotions that are more hidden or deep or profound, you kind of have to kind of short-circuit it a little bit. I think the first cartoonist to figure that out was Charles Schulz, because he was the first cartoonist to create the first sympathetic cartoon character of Charlie Brown. It was a character you actually cared for and you felt for and you wanted to make that character feel better. He felt like a real person. And somehow Schulz figured out a way of getting into the strip and coming back out so that you would feel through a character rather than just feel for a character, if that makes any sense at all. One of the biggest mistakes a young cartoonist can make is to draw the expressions of a character so that person he or she reflects the inner emotions that they're feeling, because that's not what adults do. We hide our emotions, we deceive, we trick, we lie. That's what adult life is about. So you've got to figure out as a cartoonist who's trying to write more adult stories how to communicate that in a way that feels real through either how you communicate gesture or divide up time or how you structure a story or what you show or what you don't show. So I found that frequently if I show something too much, it loses its emotional authenticity, but sometimes you can go so far over the board with that all of a sudden the emotion feels real again if you're so upfront about it in such a way that it's right in your face. Oddly, sometimes, and the only way to know that is when you're drawing it, is just to read it over and over and over again and try to have an honest emotional response to it, which frequently you have the wrong response, and then you do a strip and you publish it and you realize it was a piece of garbage where you thought it actually had some content to it. But as far as editing other things goes, when I edited McSweeney's, one of the hardest things when you're editing an anthology of comics is that you've got not only the tones of the stories butting up against each other, but you've got the visual butting up against each other. So I tried to figure out ways that where stories would complement each other and in a way almost kind of excuse each other, which I think Art and Francoise in their publication of Raw Magazine, they were really the first editors to really discover how to do that with comics. I told that to Art recently, and he claimed that he got it all from Harvey Kurtzman in Mad Magazine, but I think he's just being humble. I think he really figured out how to do it in Raw, so it's difficult to do because you can have really competing. Like, you could have a story that has just too much yellow on a page, and when you put it next to another story, it'll kill the emotional effect of the story in the opposite page. It's kind of difficult. But then if you get the right artist together, you can sometimes include things that otherwise you wouldn't have been able to. So This is all minutiae that probably means absolutely nothing to anybody. I think, I mean, Ivan Brunetti definitely has done a fantastic job in his Yale anthologies of creating books with that philosophy. And he's created the two Yale books are the books that, if you want to figure out what comics can possibly do as a literary medium, those are the two books to get, so.
Well, I guess my last question really is about a kind of personal restraint, because you sort of exercise this sort of very humble and kind and generous persona, but you have a lot of weight riding on you. Whenever anybody picks up anything that talks about you and your comics, it's the weight of history weighs on it, that that everybody wants to bandy around terms like genius, most important comic producer the last 15 years. What do you do with that when you sit down to write a comic?
To be honest, I just don't think about it, and for the most part, I don't. You remember the bad stuff that people say. You don't remember the good stuff.
Those assholes aren't there when you're paying bills.
I could quote nasty reviews that were written decades ago, and I can't remember. I was going through my letters that I'd been saving for years yesterday and putting them into a box because I just recently cleaned up my studio, and I all these nice letters I'd completely forgotten about, but I could still remember nasty things that had been written or asides that I'd read about my stuff. So it's pathetic, I think. You know, any artist would tell you that. I read a biography of Brahms recently that said that I think it was Liszt could quote something like 1,000-word criticism of his work that had been published in a newspaper years before, word for word, because it had wounded him so deeply. So we're fundamentally sad creatures, so we artists, but
desperate for acceptance.
Yeah, so but I don't know, I'm sorry I'm not more interesting. I try to put the words together, but they don't work.
No, I think that you're incredibly interesting and given us all an incredible gift in your comics.
And we appreciate you joining us.
Well, it's really kind of you to have me on. I'm really flattered.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
To you by the following people:
Christopher Hudgens, Serena Worthington, Meg Only, Audrey Mast, Robert Jacoby, Terry Griffith,
Elena Stern,
Joanna Topor McKenzie, Lori Waxman, Catherine Bourne, Lisa Boyle, Amanda Browder, Tom Sanford, Nathan Rogers Madsen,
Brian Andrews, Patricia Maloney, Mike Benedetto, Emily Heath, Christian Kiros, Mark Step Brandel, Steve Hammond, and Joseph Trippia. And I shouldn't leave off Lauren Ballone's name either.
And as always, Duncan would like to thank Joseph Mohan.
If you would like to leave pithy messages on our blog, you can do so at batitsports.com. You can email us at batitsports@gmail.com. And if you'd like to make a donation, which we would greatly appreciate because this stuff all costs money, you could do so by clicking the Donate to Us link on our website. Thanks a lot, and have a good week.